It's been about 2 months since new environmental impact rules went into effect. The EIS rules hadn't been overhauled in close to 2.5 decades, even though Supreme Court rulings handed down changed the legal landscape. We talked to outgoing executive director Scott Glenn, who has spent the last several years working on the new requirements that developers now face.
The last time the rules were overhauled was in 1996, and there was a minor amendment done in 2007. That was never compiled with the rest of the rules, so most people didn't even know it existed. And coming into the 21st century, most people do things now by email. They expect documents to be digital, readily available online. And when the rules were last done in 1996, everything was still pretty much paper-based. So, you know, one thing we thought is we need to update how this process works in kind of an everyday way, to meet how people expect things to work, but also because what the rules do is they implement the statute, right, that the legislature passes, and they explain kind of the nuts and bolts of how to go through the process and meet the requirements that the legislature laid out in the statute. And since 1996, the legislature has amended the statute several times to address different problems that have come up, but those changes did not reflect in the rules. So there were some things that were in the rules that were outdated, and you couldn't actually comply with both the statute and the rules at the same time.
So there was a disconnect.
Right. So we thought, you know, people really need help to understand how to go through this process, and we want people to be able to comply with all of the laws if we can. The courts also issued several decisions that helped us to understand and interpret the statute, and so we wanted to make sure that got reflected into the rules as well.
What types of rulings? So what cases are we talking about?
Let's see. There's been several. Most recently, Umberger versus DLNR, Kalakini versus Yoshioka, which is the rail EIS lawsuit.
So really notable cases.
Yes, that affect our understanding of how this process works. And so we wanted to make sure that those things got codified into the rules, in a way that made sense and helped the process work better, so that, you know, people didn't have to go and read the statute, read the rules, read the court cases, and then figure out how to make it all work together.
Right. You wanted something more user-friendly.
Right.
And you also took into account the concern about sea level rise and greenhouse gas emissions, too, right?
We did, yes. Climate change is a major priority for the state, certainly for governor and the legislature. During the rulemaking, the legislature passed a resolution or a session law asking the council to address sea level rise and EAs and EISs through rulemaking. And so we did. We incorporated that in. Now, whenever an agency has to make a decision about whether to do an exemption, an EA or an EIS, they have to take into account, am I in the sea level rise exposure area, which is that new area that DLNR and the state came up with to help identify areas that are subject to sea level rise or potentially subject to it.
And there's also a consideration for building affordable housing in the urban core, too.
Yes, that's right. The affordable housing question is, you know, it's a pressing issue for the whole state, just like climate change, right? It's top of mind for many people. And one of the things that we're trying to encourage with these new rule changes, putting the right stuff in the right place. You know, the state has gone through all this effort in the city, for example, or the counties, to put planning for affordable housing in a certain location, and they're accommodating all of the impacts for it, then potentially they could be eligible for an exemption. It's not an automatic exemption. There still has to be some analysis and some discussion, but it becomes a pathway to say, we'll help affordable housing that doesn't have impacts on bigger impacts on the community around it, and it's where we want it to be as a society.
So it's kind of mapping out that priority.
Yes.
So how's the rollout been? Because these rules went into effect in August.
They did. One thing to note, Governor announced he was going to sign the rules back in May, with the idea that he would say then that he was signing them in August so that people had enough lead time to get ready. You know, when you're working on an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement, those can take months or years to prepare for. And so we wanted to give people enough time to know, okay, my timeline is, you know, I'm going to be done in September and going out to the public then, so that they know that they'll be doing it under the new rules, versus if you already got started with the process, you continue under the old rules. So we rolled it out. He signed them so that they took effect in August. We have a bunch of deadlines in this process, and the day that it took effect was one of those few days where there was no deadline. So it was kind of a clean break between the old rules and the new rules. And since then, OEQC has been doing a lot of training and outreach. So we've been going to the different islands, meeting with county agencies, state agencies, you know, stakeholders, public folks, to go over, here are the changes in the rules. Here's what the rules used to say, here's what they say now, and then try to answer their practical implementation questions. So that's what the rule says now, so what do I do as a person who works for X agency dealing with Y project? For the most part, I'd say people think that the rules are clearer and easier to understand. Several longtime people working on this stuff say, okay, I get it now. I understand what I'm supposed to do. In general, I think the feedback has been overall supportive, although people always have certain things that they might have issues about or would have wished the council gone a different direction on a particular part of the rules. Overall, though, I think they're a good balance of the various interests that we try to negotiate through with development, conservation, preservation, community, cultural. You know, all of these things come together in the EIS process. We try to be respectful of those various interests in trying to update these rules.
And it was a two-year process, and you did kind of reach out to everybody to get input when you were shaping this.
It was. We spent about 2 years, what we would say formally, going through rulemaking. But really, this rules package built on the work of previous environmental councils and previous directors. So there's been an effort to update the rules for several years. And we took the work that our predecessors had done and used that as our kind of starting point that we called our first working draft. And then we did a few more working drafts. And in some ways, what the council was doing was trying to think out loud. It's trying to say, hey, we know we don't necessarily have the best answer, but here's what we're thinking. Let us know what you think. And then the council would make adjustments in its working drafts to show how it was responding to the feedback it got. And then once there's kind of a solid consensus of, okay, this is the direction to go, the council then asked governor to do the formal public hearings on the draft rules. After that was done, they did a couple more working drafts until they got to the final, which was mainly tinkering with the language after that. So all told, that took about 2 years, and roughly, I'm rounding, about 30 public meetings.
So what's been the general feedback? Did it just a more efficient, streamlined process, easier to understand for those developers that are working on projects?
For sure that it's easier to understand. The word streamline is an interesting word. I think a lot of folks have different interpretations of what that means. Council wanted to make public engagement meaningful. This whole process is meant to help get the public involved and stakeholders involved in agency decision-making before we commit things irrevocably, you know, before we say, okay, you build there and then there's something there. So what, you know, what we tried to do was say, yes, there is a definite role and a need for public input, and how can we make sure that input is as meaningful as possible? So we tried not to remove opportunities for the public to be engaged. We tried to make it more meaningful. And I think when people hear the word streamline, they're a little concerned that, oh, this means removing the public from the conversation.
And that's not the case.
That's not the case. The rulemaking is usually an administrative effort that's done by a director. And some agencies have a board that does the rulemaking. For example, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, they have the board that formally does the rulemaking and decision-making. For OEQC, the OEQC director does not have the power to make rules. The advisory board, the Environmental Council, has that power. And it's 15 people. The OEQC director is one of those 15, but the other 14 are all unpaid volunteers appointed by the governor. And they worked really hard. They did a really great job rolling up their sleeves and getting into the weeds and really understanding what updating the rules meant and trying to listen to all the different stakeholders to to understand how to balance things and how to make them practicable. You know, like, you know, there's a concern that, oh, you just changed the rule, and then people would say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. Like, what does that actually mean when I write an environmental assessment? Or as a member of the public, I'm commenting on one. So we really tried to pay attention to that, and I thought the council did a really great job putting their effort into this, coming to all these meetings, keeping that intensity and focus over 2 years is really hard for volunteers. And they did it. They did a great job.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, and not, you know, because we have a situation where we, you know, we struggle to try and get good people to sit on our boards and commissions.
Mm-hmm. And all of these folks signed up knowing what they were getting into. That when they were appointed, are you willing to work on admin rules? And they said yes. And one thing also on that is, governor appointed folks from all the different islands to serve on the board. You know, I know one of the frequent criticisms of boards is that it's too Oahu-centric. And with having 15 members, that means the board has to have 8 members for quorum to do decision-making. And so governor appointed 8 members from other islands besides Oahu. We had at least one person from each major island, including someone from Molokai and someone from Lanai, so that, you know, it couldn't be Oahu just sitting down and saying, here's what the rules should say. We always had at least 2 islands present for any meeting that we were doing decision making. One thing I hope to bring to the energy discussion is this very collaborative approach that we took on the EIS process. You know, it's really critical that we get community buy-in and folks understand and appreciate the need for renewable energy projects, and they have to go somewhere. And so how can we work with folks to really help come up with good projects and good locations that can help the state move forward and meet its climate goals?
That was Scott Glenn, director of the Environmental Office of Quality Control. He winds up his stint in that office tomorrow, Tuesday, and takes on a new challenge as director of the state's energy office the very next day on Wednesday.